From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Millions of folks have descended on the nation's capital for the historic inauguration of Barack Obama tomorrow. They're coming by the carload, the plane load, and train load, even bus load. One group of grassroots Obama supporters is en route in a bus caravan from Louisville, Kentucky. NPR correspondent Ina Jaffe is aboard the bus with them, and she's joining us now on a cell phone somewhere between... Well, hey, Ina, where are you exactly?
I am in Clarksburg, West Virginia, and we are making our way to Baltimore, where we're going to overnight, and then we're going to go into Washington in the morning.
Who are these people you're traveling with?
They are people from all walks of life in Louisville, predominantly African-American, but I have met people from 9 to probably 79 today, and... people with all different kinds of jobs and occupations, social workers and teachers and meat plant supervisors and just everything.
You know, the bus must be full of chatter, Ina. What are some of the things these people are talking about, and what are they most excited about either seeing or doing once they get to the nation's capital?
Well, I have to say that there wasn't a real lot of talking going on in the first part of this ride. We began in Louisville at about 3:30 in the morning with a send-off ceremony outside the Expressions of You coffee house. They're the ones who organized this trip. And there were prayers and speakers. And then people boarded the buses about 4:15, 4:30. So for a good part of the time, people were sleeping. But everybody just stopped for lunch. It's gotten a lot livelier. And I did talk to several people, and they told me that yes, it's historic, it goes without saying, and yet people just can't say it enough. And they talked about not only their pride in Barack Obama being the first African-American president, but also that he is not just the president for African-Americans. This is a cause for everyone to rejoice because they really feel he will be uniting people of every background in this country.
I've got about 15 seconds just to ask you this one quick question. Have you noticed anybody that's older on the bus who... for whom this would be a particularly poignant moment?
You know, there are a lot of family groups traveling together. And, yes, there is a mother with her two grown daughters. And they all acknowledge that it was different for the mom than it was for them, that she had witnessed more overt racism and experienced more in her life than they had in theirs.
Ina, thank you very much. Travel safely. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.
That was NPR correspondent Ina Jaffe traveling to the inauguration with a bunch of folks on a bus from Kentucky to Washington. It is the last day of the Bush administration. A new cabinet is poised to reshape policy and help guide the new president. Much like George W. Bush in 2001, Barack Obama has assembled a group of seasoned veterans. He has stacked the deck with a team of political heavyweights, but are there any wild cards in that pack? Joining us to put the new team under a microscope are Mary Frances Berry, a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and Robert George, associate editorial page editor for the New York Post. Welcome back to News and Notes, folks.
Thanks, Tony.
Thanks, Tony. Good to be here.
Mary, let's start with you. Would you describe this group that the president-elect has assembled as having any unified philosophy, or is it too early to tell whether they will gel politically?
Well, I think it's too early to tell. The most important thing about them is that Obama wanted them, all of them. I think that you have Clinton and Gates, who are considered to be sort of moderate hawks on war and peace matters. You have the Treasury Secretary, who still seems to me to be the most problematic one, who was part of the responsibility for the crash that is occurring and who apparently doesn't know how to do his own taxes. But that's sort of a wild card. Eric Holder, who's a friend. You have a group of friends of the president, acquaintances and friends and people who play basketball and who seem superbly qualified and are mainly either Ivy Leaguers or they went to major educational institutions, public and private. And then you have people like Gates, the holdover, and Clinton and Leon Panetta at CIA, who is a Clinton holdover who used to be a Republican. So I don't think that there's a unifying theme. Most of them seem to have a lot of experience. Perhaps that's a unifying theme.
Well, Robert, I want to ask you, because Mr. Obama has said that he wants his team to incorporate many different perspectives and voices. Who on the cabinet, so far at least, is most likely to represent that different voice?
Well, I mean, already there is a little bit of attention, and Mary alluded to that with Robert Gates. I mean, he is obviously the former President Bush's soon to be former President Bush's choice for Defense Secretary, and it would be most likely to try and put a pause on whatever schedule President Obama would like to write down in terms of starting to reduce troops in Iraq. So my sense would be that would be the most likely area in terms of Iraq policy and also how troops are going to be deployed in Afghanistan. That would be the clearest example of where there might be a little bit of not necessarily tension, but at least a viewpoint that Obama might not immediately gravitate to.
Well, you know, Mary, there have been some issues raised about how well Team Obama vetted some of his cabinet choices. You've already made reference to Treasury. Bill Richardson, we could throw him in there. Eric Holder also
SEC pick, who's named Mary Shapiro, I believe is a name, who's been named in a couple of lawsuits alleging that she lied in reference to a regulatory matter that she was overseeing.
That's
right,
another one.
So the
question is, does Obama may in fact not have, I have read this, as many appointees in place than Bush had at the time when he took office? Should this be a concern?
Well, it's a concern because even though he won't have as many in place, the numbers will not be the same. It is a matter of some urgency to get them in place, in particular what's going on in the country. But it's also important to get the right people, and it's also important to get people in whom we can have confidence. The part that's bothersome is the lack of good vetting of these people. It seems
exactly
to be that, I mean, I've been vetted several times by administrations and for jobs and security clearances and all kinds of things. But I don't understand how somebody wouldn't find out about the tax thing. One of the things with the Treasury Secretary, they always ask you about those questions when you're vetted. And I don't understand why the Mary Shapiro matter shouldn't have come to the fore. And I do not understand why they didn't take seriously the Bill Richardson. Eric Holder, I think they knew everything about his situation, and I don't think that his situation is disabling. It's just something to make for Senator Spector and others to have fun with.
That's right. I mean, the Holder stuff that they are focusing on, or pardon the expression, holderovers from when he was deputy under the Clinton administration, both the Mark Rich pardons and the FALN terrorist pardons as well. So everybody knew about them. I think what's really troubling is that the irony you have here is that the area where things at least are under certain control, say Iraq and the foreign policy questions, those people are going to be in. Gates is obviously in there already. Hillary Clinton will be approved immediately. So the foreign policy side of the equation is going to be set. But the area where the crisis really is, the economic issue, that's where people will not be in place. And that is rather troubling.
It's
going to be interesting to see whether Obama sticks, as he has so far, with the SEC nominee and with the Treasury nominee, or if he picks somebody else. Many people are willing to give him a pass on both of them, even though I think that if they were in some other administration, they would not be given a pass, just because people are in a celebratory mood and they'd like to give Obama a pass on everything. But I don't think they should, because he has to be taken to task just to make sure that the people around him do a better job on everything else they do.
Absolutely. Let me ask you about a person we don't hear very much about, but we are going to see an awful lot of, probably beginning Wednesday, I would imagine, Robert Gibbs. He is going to be the public face of the administration as the press secretary. Now, this is a very high-profile role coming out of the White House. What are the both of you expect from Gibbs, and what do you know about him?
Well, from what I've seen of him, he probably has one of the key qualities you're going to want in a spokesman is that he seems to have the complete confidence of the soon to be president, and from what I understand, he is somebody who is going to be in the room when the important decisions are made. And if you really want to have a high quality spokesperson, you're going to want somebody who's going to be there when the decisions are made, so he knows exactly what the formulations are, and he can then translate that into the public voice.
It certainly sounds like that's the way it should go. Is that how you would expect it, Mary?
Right. It seems that way, and the history of that post is that people who don't have that access, D.D. Myers didn't have it in the first Clinton administration. If you don't have that access, then you're out there trying to talk to the press.
Scott McClellan did not have it in the Bush administration,
right,
for example.
And so I think that that's a terrible job to have if you do not have the president's support and if you are not in the meeting so that you know what's going on in the meetings, and Gibbs seems to have that access.
Well, let me thank both of you, Mary and Robert, and wish you both a happy Martin Luther King Day, the day before the inauguration.
All right.
Same to you, Tony. Same to you. Have a safe flight back, Barry.
All right. Thank you.
That was Mary Frances Barry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and Robert George, assistant editorial page editor for the New York Post. He joined us from the NPR studios in New York City. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. The Bush era is over.
Like all who have held this office before me, I have experienced setbacks, and there are things I would do differently if given the chance. Yet I've always acted with the best interests of our country in mind. I have followed my conscience and done what I thought was right. You may not agree with some of the tough decisions I have made, but I hope you can agree that I was willing to make the tough decisions.
Tomorrow marks the end of President George Bush's time in office. He leaves the White House with one of the lowest approval ratings ever. But how will history judge the 43rd president, and what will be the Bush legacy? For more, we have Sherrilyn Ithell, a civil rights lawyer and a law professor at the University of Maryland Law School, and Ron Christie, CEO of Christie Strategies. He is also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Welcome, folks.
Good to be here.
Let's start with this, Ron. President Bush faced a lot of challenges both home and abroad during his presidency. Last week, he shared his views on his performance. It was mixed, which I don't think comes as a surprise. We know what the criticisms are going to be, but what victories do you think he had that may become part of his legacy? Domestic first.
Well, I think he has several meaningful contributions to the American landscape that people will look back and say, thank goodness that President George W. Bush was in office. On the domestic front, I think the most important thing that the president was able to accomplish working in a bipartisan manner with the Congress was a piece of legislation called No Child Left Behind. That bill made sure that we could have a criteria established to determine whether or not our students were learning in schools, whether or not schools were performing adequately, and then use that as a benchmark so that parents could understand what was going on with their children's education. There have obviously been some hiccups with that bill, but what we've seen over the last several years is that the achievement gap has narrowed between African-American and Hispanic students towards white students in a level that we haven't seen before in history. I think if you also look at what the president tried to do in 2001 and 2003 to stimulate the American economy coming out of a recession when he first took office was to enact a wide-sweeping set of tax cuts that stimulated the American economy and led to a record 50-week job growth in this country, or I should say 50 months. So there are several things that he's done on a domestic and an international front that people will look back and say, you know, George W. Bush had it right when he worked with the Congress to get these landmark achievements accomplished.
Well, Sherrilyn, from the domestic policy perspective, what do you think the president wishes he could do over?
Given what I've seen of George W. Bush, I don't think he has any regrets. Here's what I think he should wish he'd done differently. I think, first of all, the tax cut issue that Ron mentioned is a serious problem. This is a president who asked us to go into war on two fronts in Afghanistan and Iraq and refuse to ask the American people to sacrifice, refuse to project out the money that we would need to engage in these undertakings. And instead, he told us to go shopping, and he insisted on tax cuts that benefited the wealthy. And the result of it is that we didn't make those sacrifices, and we ended up on two fronts in very expensive wars, spending billions of dollars and utterly unprepared for the catastrophic problems with the economy that we've experienced under President Bush's watch. So I can't imagine that this will be a legacy that will be regarded as a victory or an accomplishment for George W. Bush. I think his domestic accomplishments, ironically, are not ones that he intended. For example, I think that the problems and the deficiencies in the response to Katrina actually have convinced the American people that we do need government, that the Republican mantra of smaller and smaller government, of Grover Norquist wanting to, you know, make government small enough that he could drown it in the bathtub, that Katrina showed us that we actually need government to do certain important things like preserve infrastructure and be available to respond to the kinds of disasters in a competent way. And that's the other piece, that competence counts. You know, this is an administration that regularly derided those who were elitist, that derided education, that derided science, and that focused on the pageantry of feelings and hunches. And what we saw is that what we really need is competence. We, you know, Brownie may be a very affable, nice guy to have a drink with, but he shouldn't have been FEMA director. And so some of these things that are going to be, I think, part of the Bush legacy are not things that President Bush intended, but are just the consequences of the catastrophic mistakes that he made.
From a foreign policy standpoint, Ron, there is the Iraq War, of course, but Bush did seem to have some success in Africa, more so than perhaps any U.S. president before him in terms of his efforts in the battle against AIDS. One, do you agree with that assessment? And two, do you think that his work there will help salvage his reputation internationally?
Well, again, I think that history is one that is going to treat the president far more kindly with the ability and retrospection of time than where we see right now. Obviously, President Truman left office with very low approval ratings. President Nixon left office with very low approval ratings. And over the course of time and after the cause of reflection, I think Americans recognized the important contributions that these presidents had made. Looking at Africa, I think there's no question the president had an initiative called PEPFAR, which is the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief. And what the president was able to do was to work with the Congress to ensure that not only those who were suffering from HIV/AIDS, but also those who were suffering from malaria were able to get the treatment and able to get the assistance from the United States that they didn't have before. And also, another program that people don't talk about as much, Tony, is something called the Millennium Challenge program. The Millennium Challenge account was a program that sought to tie economic assistance from the United States to those countries or those democracies around the world that were willing to make systematic improvements in the way that they conducted their elections, the way that they had transparency with their own people in order to receive assistance. So it was the promotion of democracy, and perhaps I would say the signature accomplishment there is Ghana. Ghana was a country that had received a good deal of assistance from the United States under Millennium Challenge. They just had a successful democratically elected government transition to power, and I think it's working.
Well, let me let Sherilyn jump in because we only have about 30 seconds left to get your perspective on this issue of Bush's legacy, particularly with regard to Africa.
Well, I think the jury's out. I mean, I agree with Ron on the malaria initiative and some of the other health initiatives, including AIDS, although I think the issue of use of condoms and contraception being tied to the AIDS work is deeply problematic and is likely to be addressed by the Obama administration. I do think that, you know, there are a number of problems in Africa that really suffered from the inattention of the administration, Zimbabwe being one and the growing problems in the Congo being the other. I think the issue of security in on the African continent and the efforts of the United States to have a military presence on the continent in order to address concerns about the development of terrorism is going to be is a potential problem that we're going to see growing into the future. I think the seeds have been planted in the Bush administration. I think very few people are aware of the increased military presence of the United States on the African continent and how that may be perceived by Africans. And so I think the possibility of Africa becoming a battleground in many ways between the United States and those opposed to the policies of the United States is a potential problem that may mushroom in the future. So that one, I think the jury's going to still be out, and it may not be quite as rosy a picture as Ron paints.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much, Sherrilyn and Ron. Sherrilyn Ifill is a civil rights lawyer and a law professor at the University of Maryland Law School. Ron Christie is CEO of Christie Strategies. He's also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Now on to our bloggers roundtable. As millions descend on Washington, D.C. for Barack Obama's inauguration, folks in the blogosphere are buzzing about this momentous occasion. And from ice cream to cognac, the president-elect has inspired an industry of Obama merchandise. What else is on sale online? Here to tell us what the blogs are saying about tomorrow's inauguration is Harry Allen, who maintains the blog Media Assassin at harryallen.info. Patrice Yersic, who blogs at afrobella.com, and Robert Redding, the publisher of readingnewsreview.com. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Tony.
Nice to have you. Let's start with this one. The whole country, okay, seems to be engaged in the inauguration, and that includes the blogosphere. So starting with you, Robert, how would you describe what you're reading and seeing online? Is it the most hyped up you've ever seen?
It is. It's one of those that has been connected to, of course, Martin Luther King's birthday. The hype around the inauguration is always big, but not as big as what we've seen with this president. I've been talking to lots of people on the ground. Lots of people are excited and energized. There's lots of energy in the streets and on the web as well. And I am just amazed at what we're seeing and the amount of news that we're seeing.
You know, Patrice, everywhere you go, it's just Obama, 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 Obama. And then you turn the page and it's Obama, 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 Obama. It's crazy.
It is pretty crazy. I mean, on my own blog, you know, I'm getting a lot of comments about from people who are there, and I'm also on Twitter, which, you know, the microblogging, and people who are there, the energy that they feel, you know, it's a palpable thing. It's a beautiful moment that we're experiencing.
Absolutely. You know, Harry, one thing that we've noticed here at News and Notes is the number of items bearing the likeness of the new president, everything from soup to nuts. Some of the more clever marketing tributes include things like Ben and Jerry's ice cream, which is putting out a new flavor called Yes Pecan, and Hennessy has created a special edition bottle of cognac called 44 in honor of the 44th president. I mean, the list is endless. What have you been seeing for sale online?
Well, on Media Assassin, I think the most outrageous item that we posted on was the Obama dildo.
Mm.
Yeah.
My mouth just fell open. I don't know what to say about that. That's pretty. Well, let's just move on. What else have you been seeing?
It runs the gamut. I mean, I think, but to me, in terms of using Obama's face to sell a product, I think that the most outrageous thing is the news itself. And by that, I mean the way that his ascension to the position of 44th president is being used to sell ad time and to sell a very, if you will, comforting and passive story of the changing of the guard.
Well, you know, what's interesting about that, from my perspective, Robert, is that I wonder whether or not the Obama victory is being trivialized by this kind of merchandising. It's one thing to be excited about the first African-American president of the United States. We all get that. But is there a line that should be drawn when making dedications to the president, do you think?
Yes, and I think it should start with Hennessy. I was a little taken aback until the whole dildo one. By the Hennessy 44, you know, it's being marketed in black cities. It's, you know, this is definitely pimping the legacy, the short legacy that Barack Obama has. I mean, Barack Obama stands for something other than being a rapper, a drug dealer, a basketball player, a football player, being an intellect. And Hennessy is not promoting that through their product. That's the problem that I have. So, yes, I think there's definitely, a trivialization of what Barack Obama is talking about. Even as an independent, I give him some, I guess, as they would say, dap for what he's talking about, the substance, the meat that he's talking about bringing to the table.
Well, let's not make any further reference to that one particular product, but let's talk about whether or not it does cross the line, as Robert has suggested. Patrice, what's your thought?
I think the one ray of sunshine with the Hennessy story is that, you know, a percentage of their proceeds is going to be donated to the Thurgood Marshall College Fund. But other than that, it really underscores a kind of crass commercialism that I'm sure makes Barack Obama very uncomfortable. I mean, he's not going to be cracking that bottle. You know, this is something that's being made for the people who are celebrating around him, you know, the people who are in D.C. right now and going to parties and that kind of thing. And I like that he counteracted it by hosting this, you know, day of giving back to the community. And I think that's he really wants to kind of underscore that part of his legacy more than this the celebration and the T-shirts and the coins that, you know, people are hawking on TV.
Well, you know, there are other ways of celebration. And here's one coming up now. Songs about the president. Nothing new there, certainly, except some of the songs about Barack Obama are coming from corners not usually associated with this kind of creative music. Here's an example of an oldie being turned into a goodie.
And for love's sake, he decided to make a promise to us all. And when he wrote the audacity of hope, we could make a change.
Reach for a higher plane.
We build it up.
Well, that, of course, is the husband and wife singing, songwriting duo Ashford and Simpson with a remake of their long-ago hit, Solid as a Rock. Have you folks been hearing other songs online, Robert?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah?
Oh, absolutely. We've been playing one on the radio show for some time now. That's the one by Young Jeezy along with Nas, the first black president, in tribute to Barack Obama. And they talk about how they have been inspired by Barack Obama. I think it's beautiful when artists are inspired versus corporations that are inspired to make money.
Mm-hmm. Really? Now, what do you say about that, Robert? I mean, some of these songs, they're intended to make money too, aren't they?
Well, I think that, yes, they are definitely intended to make money, but what we're seeing with young people, especially I think with the Jeezy record along with Nas, we're seeing is that blacks, young people are seeing, even rappers themselves are seeing something other than themselves as a standard for black people to emulate. And if rappers themselves start saying, hey, you know what, he's worth paying attention to, maybe our young people say that as well. In addition to that, my attorney told me he attended an event last night with MC Lyte's manager where they were talking about eradicating the N-word for a day on the 20th within rap music itself. So that kind of thing is where I look for things to go, because my N-word usage at this point is something that I don't use, not even as a term of endearment, and I don't think anyone else should.
You know, I'm sorry, I said, Robert, I meant to go to you, Harry, to get your answer. But what I'm going to ask you all to do, because we're coming up on the break, is just to sit tight, and we're going to continue this discussion talking not only about the music surrounding the celebration of the inauguration of Barack Obama, but we're going to talk about a number of other items as well, and whether or not, think about this, whether or not people are a little too casual about our new president. So stand by. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. We're back now with our bloggers roundtable. We're joined by Harry Allen, who maintains the blog Media Assassin at harryallen.info, Patrice Yersic, who blogs at afrobella.com, and Robert Redding, the publisher of readingnewsreview.com. Before the break, we were talking about music and whether or not celebrations in music have more integrity, shall we say, than celebrations on T-shirts and coffee mugs and things of that sort. And, Harry, I was trying to get to you, and I went back to Robert by mistake. What's your thought on this?
Well, I don't necessarily think that they have more, if you will, honesty or integrity. I think that, you know, as we were saying earlier, that some of these products that emblazon themselves with Barack Obama's name or his face are contemptible. But I think the Solid as a Rock remake is kind of contemptible as well. I think the original record was much better and probably served the purpose. But Ashford and Simpson are creative people and certainly entitled to say what they want or make the kind of music they want about the president.
Well, Patrice, I want to talk about another topic with you, to begin it with you, and it's about the perception of Barack Obama that, besides skin color, seems to set him apart from previous presidents. George Bush, even Bill Clinton, seen as regular guys to a large extent as they went into office, but do you find that Barack Obama is what we might call informal in a way that we have never seen before? And does he need to be presidential looking and acting in a way others have to maintain that perception of power?
I think he's kind of towing a very careful line right now. I think, I mean, to me, I like the fact that he seems relatable. I like the fact that he's going to places in D.C. and getting hot dogs, and he's, you know, known as a basketball player and a kind of a person that you can relate to. But I don't know if I think that he has crossed the line into being too accessible or too informal, you know. And he's conducting himself in a very careful way so that, you know, the people who have supported him all along can identify with him, but at the same time, I can still respect where, you know, he's going to be presidential.
What's your take, Robert?
Well, I think that Barack is definitely conducting himself in a very professional manner. I'm not sure how that resonates with the rest of America, black versus white. I know that he definitely is the epitome of, I guess, learned and skilled and trained that we see in D.C., we see in New York and Atlanta for black people. But I'm not sure how that actually connects with white people. I know that a lot of the issues that he talks about connects with white people, but I'm not sure if the basketball court in the White House, if that's your question, will relate to most white people. Maybe some white people in Indiana, but not the rest of the country.
Well, you know, Harry Allen, the New York Times ran a poll yesterday saying that 91% of Americans approve of Obama right now. How long do you think America's love affair with him is going to last?
I think it's going to be short. And I think the question you're asking about the overfamiliarity with him is a really good one. And I think it's something that we're going to see take place as race really starts to make its appearance in terms of how Obama is talked about and what happens in his administration. Much of that's going to really depend on how successful he is in terms of carrying out the goals he set for himself and for the nation. But I think that we're going to see, I think we're going to see something wholly new here and wholly old as well. And I think that familiarity is part of it.
Are any of you still in disbelief, and I'm assuming you were and admitting that I was, that America elected a man of color to be president of the United States? And if you are still in disbelief, do you think that's going to change once you see Obama actually sworn in, Patrice?
I'm not in disbelief at all. I mean, it's incredible, you know. I mean, it's something you grew up watching movies and TV shows where they feature a black president. Sometimes it's kind of a comical advantage thing. You know, you never really believed you would see. I grew up believing that America was too racially polarized for this to happen. But it's really inspiring. I can't get over it. It fills me with hope and inspiration and all kinds of emotions I can't even quite put into words.
You in disbelief, Robert, or you believe in it?
This
now?
Is in no way to diminish Barack Obama's accomplishment or his vast amount of education and preparation for this day. But, and whites have been accused for saying this already and were accused of being racist. But I want to say that I don't think America had another choice. I don't think we could take four more years of the same. And I think he was right in that he positioned himself the way he needed to. And, yeah, I'm still in a little disbelief about it. And I hope that he can stay alive to do some of the things that he wants to do, because that is a concern.
Well, our time is out. Harry, unfortunately, I can't get the last word to you. We'll have to save you for the next conversation on this topic, which you know, all of you know, we will be revisiting. Harry Allen maintains the blog Media Assassin at harryallen.info. He joined us from NPR Studios in New York. Patrice Yersic blogs at afrobella.com. She joined us from the studios of the Miami Herald. And Robert Redding publishes reddingnewsreview.com. He joined us from Louisiana. Everybody, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tony.
Tourism officials estimate that 2 to 4 million people will crowd into the nation's capital for President-elect Barack Obama's inauguration tomorrow. For many, witnessing history trumps dealing with the logistical headaches, including how to pay for the trip to the nation's capital. Faraj Dea spoke with Shirley Smith, who is making the journey from California on a shoestring budget with her 17-year-old foster daughter, Brandy.
I sent an email to our congressman, Adam Schiff, and said I'd like to have two tickets. And doggone it, you have to be careful what you ask for. I got them. So the plan went into effect.
What's the plan?
Well, the plan was, hey, you know, this is not something we budgeted. People keep going, well, it must be expensive. I think things are expensive if you make them expensive. So the plan was to cut corners.
Tell me what your idea of this trip is, why you felt you had to go, even though it sounds like times are tight for you, as they are for many people.
Well, it's just so much history. And I think for me, as an older person, I might have said, I'll just watch it on TV. But I have a 17-year-old. And I just knew that it would mean so much to her, because she has followed that election closer than I did. She would update me. So this was her Christmas present, her graduation present, her life present. And if she gets married, it's her wedding present.
Her name's Brandy.
Brandy.
Tell me about Brandy.
Brandy's a jewel. I've had her since she was 2 days old. She's a foster child. I became guardian when she was about 3 years old. She's a fabulous artist. She's really her own person. She works hard at being her own person.
How did you tell your daughter that you had gotten these tickets?
Well, on Christmas morning, I told her to go out and check her email, and she might have something worth talking about at breakfast, because I had gotten the email congratulations letter from Adam Schiff, and I forwarded it to her, to Brandy, on Christmas Eve. So she went out to the computer, and she came back in, and she sat down at the dining room table looking absolutely stunned. I said, do you have something to say? She said, I just died and went to heaven.
Wow. So when you got these tickets, you said, we're going to do this by hook or by crook, and we're going to have to make some sacrifices. What kind of sacrifices are we talking about?
Well, as I said, there'll be no prom. We're not doing graduation gift. We're not doing graduation pictures. That's probably 5,000 saved right there. That's sort of a joke, but there's a lot of expense. There was no Christmas gifts. Meals have changed, but they probably needed to change anyway because the economy is tight. So we have learned that stuff just isn't getting wasted. There is no out to dinners. I truly miss that. Gave up bottled water. So I think we're pretty much living like we should have been living anyway.
Those are some significant changes. So how much is the trip costing you?
Well, I have not, you know, when I say we're on a tight budget, I haven't really written down exactly where we're spending. I've more written down where we're not spending. There'll be no trinkets purchased. People say, oh, that's really cruel. Well, you got to make choices when money is tight. You either do this or you do that. So an airplane ticket versus trinkets, we chose to fly.
What have people in your life said when you told them that you were going, first of all, and that you were willing to make some significant changes and cuts in what has not been an extravagant lifestyle?
Well, it's kind of interesting because I think what people have said, number one, oh, my God, I can't believe it. I'm really jealous. How did you manage? But people really don't want to know how you manage, because when you tell them, they're not willing to do those kinds of cuts, even in their everyday life. So I guess they wind up saying, well, knowing you, that's pretty much what I would expect to hear.
What does it mean to you to be a foster parent?
Well, I don't see being a foster parent any different to being a parent. My natural children, I have four of them. Two of them were really pretty annoyed that Brandy got the trip and they didn't. But they're adults and they're pretty much on their own. And if they wanted to go, they could have organized to go. I don't see being a foster parent any different to being a parent. I see it as a job. People go, that's cold. It's not cold. It's a 24/7 job, whether you birthed them or whether you got them from the agency.
How do you feel about this moment in history?
It's overwhelming. It's something that words really don't convey. I remember on the night of the election night, everybody I knew, they just walked around crying. You know, it's like, well, why are you crying? I have no idea. But it was just tears, tears, tears all the time. So I can't put into words what it's really like. But I think Brandy sort of captured it when she said she had died and gone to heaven.
I can only imagine the joy and the challenges of this trip. So, Shirley Smith, thank you.
Thank you.
Columnist Shirley Smith will be attending President-elect Obama's inauguration in Washington, D.C. tomorrow, along with her foster daughter, Brandy Armstrong Morrow. In politics, getting on a campaign's bandwagon early could help bring you to victory. The Isisarets Drill and Drum Corps led the bandwagon in Iowa, where candidate at the time, Barack Obama, won his first big victory. So the Isisarets are a group of mostly African-American kids from Des Moines, and tomorrow they will represent the Hawkeye State in the presidential inauguration parade. We've got Pam Williams on the line. She's assistant director and head drill instructor for the team. And Zion Freeman, he's 7 years old and plays the cymbals. How are you?
Good.
Good. I'm glad to hear you. Pam, are you there?
Yes, I'm here too.
Let's talk about the group. You managed to build a relationship with the president-elect. How did that start? Because I'm sure everybody, a lot of groups, wanted to get into that parade.
We started by, it was at one of the debates that they held in Des Moines at Drake University at 8 a.m. in the morning, and we got up at 5 o'clock to go out and be a part of that.
Now, I know that your band has performed for big audiences before, but is this the biggest and the most prestigious performance of this group so far?
Yes, this will be the biggest audience ever.
Really? Are you excited?
I'm very excited.
I can hear. He's not saying anything, but I bet, Zion, you're excited too, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Hi, I understand that you are an expert at your instrument. What instrument is that?
Cymbals.
The cymbals. So those are the ones that make all the noise when you crash them together, right?
Yes.
Okay. What did your family say when they found out you were going to go and perform for the new president of the United States of America?
Yay! Woo-hoo.
They were very happy for you, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Are you excited about going?
Yes.
Really? Do you have all your moves down?
Yeah.
Yeah? Can you describe one of them for us? One of your moves?
You go up to the sign, right foot, you go side, back, you go back to the left, go down, go back to the right, go back to the left, and do a hump.
Man, you sound like you have it together, my man. You do, don't you?
Yeah.
Yes, you do. Ms. Williams.
Yes.
I understand that you're pretty tough on the team and that two kids were told that, hey, get a haircut or you're not going.
Right.
Did they do it?
They're right here with me, looking like the beautiful young men I knew they were under those mohawks.
No mohawks going from Iowa to
No mohawks coming from Iowa.
What did the family say to you about you know, taking the band to this occasion?
All the families are really excited. The kids are just overwhelmed. They can't wait till tomorrow. This is just a feat for this team. We've been together 29 years, and this is the top of the tip for us, boy, to get to come to Washington, D.C. for President-elect Obama. It's just like we finished all that we started 2 years ago when the campaign started in Iowa.
Well, congratulations. Zion, let me ask you another question. Have you met Barack Obama yet?
Yes, last year's state fair.
Yeah, so what was that like?
It was kind of freaky.
Kind of freaky. And why was that, Zion?
Because I never met, and it's the first black president, and I never met him before.
You never met a black president before?
No.
Guess what? Nobody else had either. So, Zion, what are you going to say to him when you see him again, if you get a chance to? What are you going to say?
Good luck moving into the White House.
Good luck moving into the White House. You have any advice for him really quickly on what he should do first as the new president?
make the troops come back home.
All right, we'll pass that message along to him. Zion, thank you very much. Man, you have a great time. Represent your state and your band and your family, okay?
Okay.
I appreciate you coming on. Pam Williams, I appreciate you coming on as well. Thank you
very
much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Zion Williams plays the cymbals for the Isisarets Drill and Drum Corps of Iowa, and Pam Williams is the assistant director and head drill instructor for the Corps.